Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 104, a few degrees cooler than average. We hit 100 yesterday. Clear skies on the way for tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-70s. 103 for a high tomorrow, 104 on Thursday, 105 for a high on Friday. Right now in Phoenix with relative humidity of 7%, it's 94 degrees. There's been speculation the Arizona Coyotes may be leaving Glendale after next season, but it appears they won't end up in neighboring Nevada. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, the team will soon announce its arena plans, destination unknown.
The Associated Press is reporting that the National Hockey League has settled on Las Vegas as its choice for expansion. That's provided backers can come up with a $500 million franchise fee. The Vegas bid, though, does promise more than 13,000 season ticket deposits and a brand new arena already built on the south end of the Strip. Las Vegas is the largest metropolitan area without a professional sports team, and concerns over corruption related to the city's gambling industry have largely vanished. At the same time, the Coyotes are expected to announce this month where the team will play the 2017-18 season after finishing the final year of its lease at Gila River Arena. The team and the city have been unable to come up with a long-term deal to keep hockey in Glendale. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
Members of the Phoenix City Council later today will appoint a replacement for former Councilman Bill Gates. Gates resigned his seat to run for one on the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. There are 9 applicants, 5 of whom have said they'll run in November's special election. Assuming a candidate gets a majority in that election, they'll serve out the rest of Gates' term, which runs through 2019. If nobody gets more than 50% in November, there'll be a runoff. Dustin Gardner covers Phoenix City Hall for the Arizona Republic. And Dustin, what'll happen at today's council meeting?
There are 9 applicants for the open city council seat. They will each have 5 minutes to make a presentation. And when that's finished, the council will accept nominations from council members. And the first person to receive a majority vote of the council members present will automatically get the seat.
So at the end of the candidates, everybody getting their 5 minutes, is there a particular order for a council member to make a nomination? Because I would imagine that there may be multiple candidates who, in theory, could get a majority of the council.
Yeah, and that's really where the timing of the nominations come into play. Because it is the first person who receives a majority of the council members present, everyone's going to probably be competing to get their nomination in first if there's not a consensus, which doesn't sound like there is at this point. So a council member who can make their nomination first will have better odds of getting their person in if they can cross the 4 or 5 vote threshold, depending on how many council members are at the meeting.
So to do that, is that just a matter of like raising your hand fastest or like pressing your request to speak button fastest?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's the first, council person who can jump in there and make their nomination first gets the first vote.
Who are some of the folks who are running for this, what sounds like a temporary council position?
Yeah, so there are 9 people who applied, and it's a pretty wide range of people. We have a former councilman, Craig Tripkin, who represented Central Phoenix in the 1990s. We have Deborah Stark, the city's former planning director. We have Ann Wallach, who is the former chair of the Maricopa County Democratic Party. And then there's a wide range of people who are kind of seen as political activists or not necessarily former elected officials, but people who are known in city political circles, neighborhood activist types.
So given the fact that whoever is appointed today could serve a few months or maybe a few more than a few months, what kind of impact might they have on the city council?
There's a lot at stake with this appointment, particularly right now. On July 1st, the city council is supposed to vote to increase the property tax rate. Several council members have indicated they're concerned or very opposed to that. Whoever the new appointment is, that person could have the potential to change the outcome of the property tax vote. If it is a close vote, they could definitely have the potential to swing it. And beyond the property tax vote, the council seat that is up for appointment, District 3, was previously represented by Bill Gates, who was a fairly vocal fiscal conservative. So the appointment has the potential to change some of the ideological balance on the council.
Well, when the council takes up something like this, do they try to defer to sort of the member of council who was there before and sort of what their beliefs were? Or do they see this as an opportunity to get somebody into the seat for at least a little while that maybe couldn't get elected otherwise?
You know, I don't think there's really, to be honest with you, I don't think there's much precedent to the council trying to select someone who mirrors the previous seat holder in the district. I think most of them are looking at the individual merits and positions of the applicants. Bill Gates, the council member who, you know, had represented this district, he has not endorsed anyone or indicated he supports anyone. You know, he just said that he hopes they support someone who shares his vision for fiscal accountability and development in the district. So, it really is about the politics of the individual people and their qualifications. And I think a lot of council members are pulling for people who most closely represent their beliefs or who they think are the most qualified.
Dustin Gardner covers the Phoenix City Hall for the Arizona Republic. Dustin, thanks.
Thanks so much.
The Tonto National Forest has released a final draft of its travel management plan. That's an outgrowth of a 2005 rule for the National Forest System to implement plans for motorized vehicle use in national forests. Several Arizona environmental groups are disappointed by the plan. The Tucson-based Center for Biological Diversity is one of them. Katie Davis is the group's public lands campaigner. And Katie, what are your concerns with the plan?
Sure. Our biggest concerns are that with the number of users and the amount of use that the Tonto National Forest experiences, we feel that the Forest Service has an obligation to come out with a very strong and comprehensive management plan that is really ensures that people have access, of course, to the forest, but that the animals and plants and beautiful landscapes that people go there to enjoy are also protected. And we just think fundamentally that the plan that has been released is not going to accomplish protection, which will ensure that future generations and even the people right now who enjoy the Tonto National Forest won't have the experience that we think people have come to enjoy on our national forests and our public lands.
What about this plan specifically concerns you that the service isn't doing enough?
Certainly. Well, there's a number of red flags for us. One of the clear indications is that even the way that this project was framed and the plan was framed was with the knowledge that there was intense use and damage to natural resources occurring, but that the Forest Service seems to have acknowledged that as just something that is going to occur and that they can't do that much about. Another significant red flag, especially for our organization that's focused on protecting native wildlife, is that the Fish and Wildlife Service, who has to review this plan and work with the Forest Service, has said in documentation that they expect that four threatened snakes that are listed under the Endangered Species Act will most likely be killed every year as a part of this plan. That's very concerning to us to know that essentially we can expect listed species and habitat to be damaged on regularly, and that is something that's just being accepted as okay and as a necessary cost of doing business, and we don't find that acceptable at all.
Do you think that given the current number of people who use motorized vehicles and use the Tonto for recreation, given that number, do you think it's possible to come up with a plan that would suit your needs without reducing the number of people who are using the forest?
Oh, certainly. And we've presented a number of strategies as alternative solutions to the Forest Service, some of which they've taken into account. There was, you know, specific roads that entered wilderness areas that are now going to be closed under this plan, and that's something that we certainly recommended the Forest Service do. I think it's really about identifying areas on the forest, some of which have been designated as critical habitat under the Endangered Species Act, as well as rivers and streams and riparian areas that are so critical to our watershed and where a number of the water for the Phoenix metro area that the community relies on. Those areas, we think, could be protected while ensuring that people have access to campsites, trailheads, even just driving through the forest. I mean, there's right now, current plan, or the plan that will be implemented, allows for 3,600 miles of road. That's longer in terms of mileage than it would take to drive across the country. So we think that there is certainly a way to find a balance and to allow access to areas, but then allow people as well to get away from roads and to protect specifically important wildlife areas at the same time.
Katie Davis is public lands campaigner for the Center for Biological Diversity. For another perspective, I'm joined by Ann Thomas. She's the National Environmental Policy Act coordinator on the Tonto National Forest and the project lead for travel management there. And Ann, how do you try to determine where motor vehicles are okay in the forest and where they're not?
Well, currently, the two northern ranger districts, the Payson and the Pleasant Valley districts, are open to cross-country travel. So in those two district areas, you can go anywhere that you would like, so long as you're not causing resource damage or safety to the public. So the first thing we had to look at is, of course, that is prohibited by the rule. So we had to look at how we could provide access to the public so they can get to the activities they wanted to get to, such as getting to one of our many lakes, get to trailheads. And then we also wanted to look at the portion of the public that rides motor vehicles, and that is their main recreation purpose. The rule is also very specific about making sure that you're also looking at the resource. So one of the things that we had to look at is, was the access creating damage to the resource? And was there a way that we could still provide that access in a way that would either minimize or completely alleviate that type of damage to the resource?
Would you say that it was your goal to provide access wherever possible and try to minimize the numbers of places where vehicles just could not go at all?
No, it's a balancing act. So it's very easy to recognize that the Tonto is one of the largest land-based forests in the system. And then we're also next to one of the top 10 or 15 urban centers in the nation. So trying to figure out how to allow for the use and enjoyment of our forest, not just for those seeking to recreate using a motor vehicle, but we also have to take into consideration those that are interested in driving to a trailhead at one of our wilderness areas and then hiking back into the wilderness area to get away from that urban influence.
As you no doubt know, a lot of environmental groups are disappointed in the amount and I guess maybe the placement of some of the areas that you have designated as okay for motorized vehicles. What do you make of some of those groups' concerns?
Part of the process that we go through is to take into consideration the public input, and these groups definitely provided input. One of the things that we looked at is we looked at the routes of their concern, and we said, you know, is this a route that really gets us somewhere? Could we provide that same motorized opportunity in an area where the question of resource damage might be less or might not even exist? So as a result of taking into consideration a lot of the environmental groups' input, we actually decreased the size of some of the designated areas where the public could go. And we also took a really hard look at how motor vehicle use is affecting the forest.
Ann Thomas is the National Environmental Policy Act coordinator on the Tonto National Forest and the project lead for travel management there.
It's the show on 91.5. Along with The Takeaway's John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody.
He was working as a contract security guard at a local courthouse, and he made some statements that were inflammatory and contradictory that concerned his coworkers about terrorism.
FBI Director James Comey speaking yesterday about Omar Siddiqui Mateen. Was he a terrorist?
First, he claimed family connections to Al-Qaeda. When this was reported to us, the FBI's Miami office opened a preliminary investigation. And over the next 10 months, we attempted to determine whether he was possibly a terrorist.
Mateen was 29 years old. He was an American citizen. And after questioning him twice in 2013 and 14, the FBI determined Mateen was no terrorist. He was just an angry young man who bought a gun. He was not able to fly because he was on an FBI watch list, but that still didn't make him abnormal, according to the FBI.
We're also going to look hard at our own work to see whether there is something we should have done differently. So far, the honest answer is, I don't think so. I don't see anything in reviewing our work that our agents should have done differently, but we'll look at it in an open and honest way and be transparent about it.
One of the ironies of this whole investigation is that even if Mateen was determined to be a threat, and if he remained on those terrorist watch lists, he would have been able to go into a gun store and legally purchase the exact same assault rifle and handgun that he used on Sunday. Timothy Edgar reviewed terrorist watch lists under both the Bush and Obama administrations from 2006 to 2009. He's now a visiting fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute.
The terrorist watch list is just the comprehensive consolidated list of everyone the U.S. government suspects of being a terrorist. And the way you get on it is if one of the nominating agencies, that's what they're called, the intelligence community or the FBI, has reasonable suspicion, that's the standard, to put you on this list. And for the FBI, that pretty much equates to being under investigation, which is why Omar Mateen was on that list a couple of times while he was under investigation by the FBI.
To extend the status of being on that list to also being unable to purchase guns, would that be a significant change in the consequences of being on a watch list?
Well, it would be a change. To my mind, it's a fairly obvious thing to do, just because being on the terrorist watch list already results in you having a number of inconveniences and even sort of what would otherwise be violations of your liberty, being given extra scrutiny at the airport or even not being allowed to fly at all, being denied certain kinds of licenses like a hazmat license. So to me, yes, of course, it's a consequence that people wouldn't like.
Does anyone, any court, evaluate the probable cause or the probity of the nomination process?
No, it does not. And the reason for that is this is just a watch list. It doesn't result in your being arrested or there being a search warrant or wiretap order against you. It's basically an information sharing system for the government. So you're just put on that list based on the agency's decision that you meet the criteria. There's an analyst at the FBI who checks that and decides whether or not the information against you is strong enough that it meets the reasonable suspicion test.
So there is virtually no due process in this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is not anything like the kind of due process that we normally expect in judicial proceedings.
So given that there's no due process and that a judge doesn't evaluate the nominating process, how can you justify taking away any rights from an individual who's on a watch list?
Well, sure. I think after September 11th, we put up with a certain amount of this kind of thing for counterterrorism programs. You know, one of the justices of the Supreme Court has said, you know, the Bill of Rights is not a suicide pact. When you have these kind of compelling interests to prevent terrorism, then you can take some steps that might otherwise normally not be okay. I certainly think that, you know, the courts are going to look at whether the process is fair, and there should be improvements made in the watch listing process. I think whether to have a watch list is in itself already, in many ways, a curtailment of ordinary standards of civil liberty. But the question is, once you've decided to go down that road and have that step and use it for airport screening or license screening or other kinds of events, what sort of events should happen? And it seems to me that purchasing a gun is a pretty obvious one that you shouldn't be able to do if you're under reasonable suspicion of terrorism.
If you were going to have a watch list, you've already made the decision that you're going to have a watch list. Why wouldn't you as well add restrictions that you can't buy a gun, you can't buy explosives, you can't get a hazmat permit, all these sorts of things?
Well, I think that's exactly right. Those are the things that make sense to have triggering the watch list hit. You know, if you have a watch list hit, you don't do that sort of thing.
Well, but why wasn't it done? Why wasn't it done?
Basically, the political power of the NRA and the gun lobby has prevented the government from adopting that sort of common sense step.
Although in terms of the mass shootings that we follow and the ones that we pay no attention to here in the media, it's a tiny, tiny minority of individuals on watch lists who are involved in these shootings. For instance, Adam Lanza in Newtown would not have been caught by a watch list weapons ban. And even if he had been on some sort of mental illness watch list, he could have just grabbed his mom's gun, which is what he did.
Well, certainly none of these counterterrorism measures are foolproof or, you know, necessarily going to stop every attack. For Adam Lanza or other domestic terrorists, there is the possibility of being put on a terrorist watch list, even if you're not connected to an international terrorist group.
Omar Siddiqui Mateen is a domestic terrorist, right?
Sure. Okay. Inspired by a foreign group. So these are efforts, you know, basically where the government, the FBI, the local police, other agencies need to improve their intelligence gathering and information sharing. This is just one system that allows you to do it.
Is it conceivable that Omar Siddiqui Mateen was notified that he was on a watch list?
Almost certainly he would have known that, having been questioned by the FBI. I don't know that he was notified specifically that he was on a watch list, but he certainly knew he was under suspicion by the FBI. And if you know anything about the watch list, you know that that's a likely consequence of being under investigation by the FBI for terrorism.
Given some of the details we're learning about Omar Siddiqui Mateen, is it possible that the FBI watch list is too narrow, that it basically says, oh, he said angry things, he talked about ISIS, let's look to see if he's funding or planning something specifically involved with ISIS, and it eliminates all sorts of other personal details in Omar's life that might have bore on the question of stress, anger, likelihood of becoming unstable in some way, in this particular case, his sexuality?
I think part of this is a sophisticated question about countering violent extremism and prevention. And the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security work together to create a program where they try to stop people from becoming radicalized. And that program, I think, has been somewhat successful, but it needs to be beefed up with further, more sophisticated psychology. And perhaps they would have understood that this person was particularly at risk and thought about strategies to prevent and intervene. And that's tricky and difficult to do, obviously, because you're looking at two different approaches. One is to try to develop a criminal case against someone for terrorism, including possibly using a sting operation. And the other is trying to turn him away from a very dark path. And those can be in tension with each other. In this case, perhaps the softer approach would have worked if they had done it in a more sophisticated way. But I think that's going to require a lot of effort to put together a program that would be more effective at countering these kinds of tendencies in young men who may be looking towards going down that kind of path.
Timothy Edgar, Senior Fellow in International and Public Affairs at Brown University's Watson Institute. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry. It's growing season for one of Arizona's five C's, cotton. Farmers flood the crops during the hottest part of the year, leading to evaporation and runoff. The U.S. Agriculture Department is researching how different irrigation techniques like sprinklers work in the desert. And as Casey Kuhn reports from KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, one Native American community already using sprinkler technology has seen a huge increase in water-efficient farming.
These sprinklers are watering organic potatoes on a farm in Ok Chin. It's a test field using an uncommon technology for Arizona farms called central pivot sprinklers. It uses about 30% less water per acre, according to Ok Chin farm manager Steve Kester. Kester says in order to use their allocated water as efficiently as possible, they've modernized watering on about half their fields.
And now we're starting to move more towards sprinkler irrigation and drip irrigation. It's a matter of just conserving water is the main thing, and plus it's much more efficient and yields are increasing.
Most Arizona farmland still uses flooding. Kester says the reason farmers are reluctant to switch is because installing these new techniques is expensive, sometimes up to $1,000 more per acre. Alyssa Garcia is a young member of the tribe who works on the Ok Chin farm for the summer. She says carrying on the old farming traditions with new technologies is important to her.
We've been able to really allocate our water and use it as efficiently as we can because, again, it is a very, very sacred resource to us.
Garcia works with Leona Kakar, who is flipping through a copy of the water rights settlement between the Akchin and the United States government that she battled hard for in 1983.
I think there's just two of us still alive.
The settlement work started when she was told the Akchin had to create a council to represent their water interests, so she did. And then she was told she had to fly to Washington, D.C. to negotiate, so she did. And then she wouldn't budge on asking for 50,000 acre-feet of water to be guaranteed to them by the federal government. She says negotiations were tense.
Oh, we waited and we waited. Oh, I was getting so nervous. And one of them said, well, we've discussed this and we've decided that we will go ahead and give you the 50,000 extra. Oh, I was so relieved.
That 50,000 allowed the community to go from 3,000 acres to 15,000 acres of farmland, including corn, pecans, and cotton. Down the street from Akchin at the USDA Arid Land Agriculture Research Center, scientists like Kelly Thorpe are studying exactly how much more efficient these sprinklers are.
We have a diesel engine on board this little cart. That diesel engine is running a pump that's pulling the water out of this canal and delivering it up to the top pipe you see running along the length of the laterals.
Thorpe is standing in a field being irrigated with a high-tech overhead sprinkler system. As the little green cotton sprouts grow, he'll measure whether there will be more crop with less water. For the next generation of Arizona crops, these findings could be crucial because of water restrictions. Here's Kester with Akchin.
Right here in the Pinale MAF, I believe people are going to start getting their water cut back next year, unless something changes, you know.
After 50 years working and helping manage the farmland, KCAR is ready to turn over the reins.
I've done my part, from the ground up. I did do my part getting water here.
In a university study, sprinkler irrigation in California has had positive results on almost every crop tested. And the Akchin community may be ahead of the crowd when it comes to efficient crop watering in Arizona. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Maricopa.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein.
The United States of Women's Summit is wrapping up today in Washington, D.C. By invitation only, it brought nearly 5,000 women together to help make changes toward gender equality, with panels talking about economic empowerment and educational opportunity, among other things. Six Arizona women took part in the summit, including attorney and Guadalupe Municipal Court presiding judge Lilia Alvarez, who joins me from the nation's capital. Lilia, do you feel like you begin with a stronger foundation for change and for sharing ideas when it's only women involved in an event like this?
There is definitely a synergy that comes from just sharing a basic understanding of the journey. You and I know that still here in our beautiful United States of America, female professionals are still not paid equally for the same labor as their male counterparts. And so even, you know, though I have extensive education, I know when I walk into a room and I'm the only female in the room that I'm outnumbered. And certainly the conversation tends to go differently when I'm in a room full of women. In fact, just now I walked away from opening remarks from key agency administrators here, and there was a panel discussion highlighting an 11-year-old little girl entrepreneur who owns her own company now, her own lemonade company. And listening to her, you know, and she highlights the support that she has received.
What do you think of a generational shift? Is there, from the standpoint of talking about the 11-year-old girl with the lemonade stand or any other young girls or young women coming up, is there a goal to make it so that in some ways the challenges they face are lesser or different than the women who came before them? Or is it important that they know some of the struggles of the female leaders that came before them to sort of set a path for them?
It's a combination. As you know, wisdom, a lot of times, I don't believe comes with age. These younger generations, like this young entrepreneur, Michaela Omer, who owns her lemonade company, she's the Z generation. She says, as a member of the Z generation, she wants to understand how to integrate into, you know, sort of the adult world. And bring her creativity and her innovation to the picture. I believe that everyone in the room, thousands of us, were so supportive of her, and we listened to her because she's so wise, you know, and she's been so successful. And so there isn't that competition or even the sense that I have something to teach her that she doesn't learn herself. So it's a combination of respecting each other's experiences, understanding that together, right, 2, 3, 5,000 minds are better always than one, respecting the history, but also acknowledging that times are changing and leaders who maybe had, you know, a grasp in terms of how to best serve their communities in the past are also very curious on learning how to better connect with the young ones, you know, with people who are coming up in a different time and age.
Guadalupe Municipal Court Presiding Judge Lilia Alvarez, we've been talking about the United States of Women Summit. Girl Scouts of the USA are probably best known for making and selling cookies. They even got a big plug during this year's Academy Awards.
So I want you all to know, it would mean so much to my two little girls if we could beat Linda Dunn. So I want you to reach into your millionaire pockets, and I want you to buy some of my daughter's Girl Scout cookies. Look at my babies up there. Are you gonna deny my princesses some cookies? All right.
But the organization has been expanding its reach in recent years, including an emphasis on STEM. That direction was strengthened by Ana Maria Chavez, who became CEO of the national organization in 2013. Chavez is the first woman of color to lead the organization, and she was a Girl Scout herself while growing up in Eloy, Arizona. Ana, what's the biggest impact being a Girl Scout had on you and the direction you wanted to go in life?
So early on, you know, our troop leaders would say, you know, Ana, if you're concerned about the environment, what are you going to do about it? And so for us, it was, you know, the ability to become a philanthropist at our age by selling cookies, using that revenue to actually fund or take action projects. And it just instilled this passion in me to make a difference.
Why has the organization increased its focus on STEM education?
Well, for us, of course, we need to prepare these young ladies for their future. And we know that STEM is no longer a niche market. It is the market. And if girls are interested in it, but, however, our research shows that as early as fourth grade, they're getting the perception that perhaps they can't do math and science, that they shouldn't be raising their hands in class and saying, you know, I have the answer to that formula. So we use our Girl Scout programming to give them that opportunity to do hands-on STEM program to learn that they can do it. So when they go back to school, they have the confidence to take those courses in high school and then in college.
How important is it for there still to be an organization that is focused on just girls and raising their awareness of serious issues?
Well, recently our Girl Scouts actually took to Twitter to say, you know what, equal pay is the way to go. And so even at an early age, girls know that there is a disparity. Unfortunately, they see it in the media. They see it in the fact that the leadership structure in this country doesn't resonate with them. That leadership message isn't something that girls want to, one, look up to and then replicate. Girls love to bring people together, convene around an issue, and then empower others to take action. And so for us, we're trying to get girls to understand they can do this now. And going back to our model, you know, we create a safe space with other girls to really say, hey, as girls, we can take on an issue, and then we surround them with supportive adults who make it happen for them.
Ana, is it still good for the Girl Scouts to be so closely associated with making and selling cookies?
We love the fact that our cookie program is the largest entrepreneur program for girls in the world. It is the largest girl-run business. It's amazing. And again, they raise the revenue that stays local. They use it for their take action projects. And what they're doing day-to-day in cookie season is they're running a business. They're learning about, you know, supply chain. They're understanding, you know, how to do a cold call, how to knock on a door and ask a stranger to invest in her business. And they understand what no means. I recently heard this great story of a woman who is in business. She's a salesperson. She has a quota she has to meet every week, and she has to make a lot of cold calls. And she was saying that she feels sorry for the other people that work around her because she had so many no's selling Girl Scout cookies growing up that it's she's developed resiliency around it, and she just keeps on plugging. And that's what we're, again, allowing girls the opportunity to develop business skills at the earliest ages, and letting them understand that with that investment in their education and the investment in their local communities, they can make a difference. And we really, really want to thank everybody out there, from Chris Rock and to all those neighborhood parents who allow girls to sell cookies and they're buying cookies. They're investing not only in a girl, but the future of this country.
And Anna, finally, do you have a favorite cookie?
I do have a favorite. It's called the Samoa.
Anna Maria Chavez is the CEO of the Girl Scouts of the USA, and she's also an Arizona native.
The Copa America Centauriò Soccer Tournament is taking place in stadiums across the U.S. this summer, and the games are filling TV screens around the world.
Suddenly, it's 10-a-side soccer, and just seconds later, the best center back in the world.
Set. Pieces, Mr. Stone.
And right here in the Valley, three big games are being held at the University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale. And as soccer or football continues to grow in popularity in the U.S., one Arizona city is taking advantage of it. Tucson now has 14 Major League Soccer teams who stay, train, and play games at the Keno Sports Complex during the league's preseason. And the show's Lauren Gilger is with me for more on this. So, Lauren, how did Tucson become such a hub for Major League Soccer?
Well, it kind of started out of a big loss for the city. Tucson used to have three Major League Baseball teams there for spring training every year until they all moved up to the Valley several years ago. The Chicago White Sox went to Glendale, and the Rockies and the Diamondbacks went to Salt River Fields near Scottsdale. So they wanted to do something. I talked to Tom Moulton about this. He's the director for Pima County's Attractions and Tourism, and he says they already had FC Tucson in the city, which is a feeder team to Major League Soccer, and they knew that some teams were looking for a warm place to do preseason training in the winter.
So we had to take a look at our professional baseball stadiums that were built to the standards of Major League Baseball, and we committed to maintain the turf out there. And with the help of FC Tucson, we took a hard look at what sport is not only engaging the youth in Tucson, but also is becoming a very fast-growing professional sport. And so we were able to successfully convert professional baseball over to soccer with some minor expenses.
So they took the entire north side of the complex, which had been home to the Arizona Diamondbacks, and converted it for Major League Soccer play.
And lo and behold, after 5 years of plugging away, we're now in the rankings as far as favorite places for the teams to go and also for the fans to be seen, where we weren't showing up on the radar at all, and now we're categorized as the 25th best town to go see Major League Soccer. So we're moving up.
And Lauren, Pima County's Board of Supervisors just approved incentives for Major League Soccer for the third year in a row?
That's right. And Moulton says those incentives really helped pull some of these teams from Florida for the preseason as well. The board just approved $130,000 in sponsorship incentives to teams who come to Tucson, stay in unincorporated hotels there, mostly resorts, and market themselves during the preseason. And Moulton says this is money that is pumped back into their local economy.
The teams come and they stay in hotel rooms. And some of that money comes back through bed tax. Some of it comes back to the community through sales tax and to the state. And, of course, the state then, you know, puts some of that back into the county. And then they go out and they have to eat in restaurants and they go to nightclubs and other things that there are to do in downtown in the area. So we don't know exactly how much money they spent in the restaurants, but we do know how much money they spend at the hotels and in marketing. And if you add all those numbers up, we call them direct expenditures. That's actually dollars that we can track. And all 14 teams spent about $1.5 million.
And he says they're able to generate as much revenue at the Keno Sports Complex by using it for soccer and other semi-professional and amateur sports events as they used to when they held spring training there.
So why does he think soccer is doing so well in Tucson?
Well, he says so many kids play soccer when they're really young. It makes sense that the sport seems to be gaining ground all over the country.
I think the roots are almost in every school. So So the interest is really developed at a young age, and the soccer teams now around the United States are able to attract soccer stars from the world. And since the number one sport outside of the United States is football, which we call soccer, it's really exploded in many cities in the United States. So I think you combine all of that together, and it really seems like soccer is finally taken off.
That's Tom Moulton, director for Pima County's Attractions and Tourism. He's talking about the growing popularity of soccer in Tucson and all over the country.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks, Mark.
Some University of Arizona employees will be getting a pay raise later this fall. Many faculty, staff, and graduate assistants will see the bump starting in September. Joining me with more on this is Zachary Brooks, graduate and professional student body president at the U of A. And Zachary, for the employees who will be getting raises, how much are they making now?
Well, it really depends. I can certainly talk about graduate assistants in a much better way because I've studied that in depth. The average graduate assistant at the University of Arizona who has a 0.5 FTE, so they're working half-time, part-time, their average is $16,388 per year. According to University of Arizona Financial Aid, the cost of attendance for any student, graduate, professional, or undergraduate, is $20,900. So that's a $4,500 gap, and so it's a big deal for graduate assistants to get more money. That's the average graduate assistant.
How do those numbers compare to peer institutions? I mean, do graduate assistants at U of A make roughly what graduate assistants at other schools make?
That's probably a fair statement. Some will make much more, but then they live in New York or Los Angeles. And so, end of the day, most graduate students around the country are not doing great. And just the national numbers as far as debt goes, of the entirety of debt, over $1 trillion of student debt that's out there, loan debt that's out there. Graduate students, while they represent only 14% of the entire population, have 40% of that debt. So when it comes, you know, back to the question about compensation, if you're not getting paid as, you know, super great, you have to take on more loans to pay for, you know, family stuff such as diapers and baby food or just rent or, you know, health insurance things that come up. So it's a big deal to get a compensation increase. Can it help you save on your debt later down the line?
I don't have to tell you that universities in this state have been taking significant cuts, and the U of A has had to eliminate some positions and eliminate some courses. Do you think that the university has the money to be able to do this right now and still maintain everything else that it does?
Yes, I do. I think even with budget cuts, and budget cuts are serious, and administrators have a very hard job trying to take a budget cut on and continue to run the university. However, you know, if these compensation increases are a priority, they certainly do have the funds.
What, in your mind, will be the biggest benefit or benefits of these compensation increases going through?
I think number one was like a morale boost. I think in terms, especially in terms of staff. Number two, if you have a little bit more money in your pocket as a graduate student, maybe you don't take as many loans out, which is a nice thing. I don't know. Three, I think it can offer, let's say, a department like psychology, who competes against the best psychology departments in the country, to have a little bit more leverage when they're trying to attract some of the best and brightest to Tucson and the University of Arizona.
Zachary Brooks is the graduate and professional student body president at the U of A. Some Phoenix playgrounds include more than just swings, slides, and monkey bars. A handful have been outfitted with what's being called smart playground games. Phoenix was the first city to do this. The company behind these games is called Biba. Matt Toner is its CEO. So, Matt, what exactly is a smart playground?
A smart playground basically uses the parent's smartphone with augmented reality markers that we attach to certain pieces of playground equipment to create an entirely new breed of video game that is meant to be played outside, so the kids, instead of sitting at home, are being physically active, social, imaginative, which are all the things we want for our kids nowadays.
Why is it necessary to have video games outside? I think for a lot of parents, they tell their kids to go outside so they stop playing video games.
Exactly. Well, firstly, Absolutely, it isn't necessary to have video games outside. There are, of course, no shortage of families that are already active and dynamic and out there, but many families nowadays are having more of a challenge of managing their children's screen time. Compared to 20 years ago, kids get about 8 hours less per week of outdoor physical social play. And video games and other screens have kind of eaten up that time. So for the kids that are already physical and active and outdoorsy, this is not, you don't need Biba. But for those kids that maybe could use an incentive or encouragement or motivation to be outside again, that's where I think Biba really fits an interesting niche. We want kids to be more clamoring to go outside to play these games and have their parents go along, so we think it creates a virtuous cycle.
What are the ages that you're targeting these games to?
Biba games target two different age groups, and that's because the psychology of children changes a bit once they go to school. So we look at kids that are preschool, 3 to 6, for one category of games, and then kids that are 6 to 9 for a second category of games. Because kids, before they go to school, are more demonstrative. They want to show like what they can do. Once they're in school, they get a little more competitive. They're more outcome-oriented. So we want to make sure our games appeal to both categories.
I have to say that there seems to be somewhat of a defeatist attitude with this, in the sense that it's almost like you're acknowledging that you can't get kids to just go outside for outdoor sake, that you need to sort of lure them outside with the promise of another video game.
I would probably disagree with that sentiment, to be honest with you, although I understand where it's coming from. The fact is that we have kids nowadays. Any kid who's 8 years old or younger has only grown up with touchscreen devices. They're surrounded by them. And this is a reality that is not likely to change. So there's a lot of challenges in raising kids that are fully media saturated. So what we're trying to do is not put the genie back in the bottle. That's just not going to be possible. But we're saying, what are the good things we can extract from this and use as motivators and incentives to have kids take on other challenges they might not find as interesting right away? It's kind of the Mary Poppins philosophy. A spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. So giving them these little props with our games, we get a lot of meaningful activity. And if you were to actually go to a park and play one of our games and go through a play test, you'll find that we design them to be 10% paying attention to the screen and 90% actually engaged in physical, social, imaginative play.
What have you found so far as how these are used, how much these games are used with the parks that you're at in Phoenix?
Well, what we're finding is the data so far is a little clumpy, which is sort of interesting. By that I mean we find like with some users, they'll play the games once, and then there's a long period of not playing, then they'll play again, and then there's a long period of not playing, and that's not uncommon with games on mobile phones. But with other users, we find that they play 2 or 3 times right away, and then we'll notice often later on the same day, they'll play 2 or 3 times in another playground, which means that they're going home from the place where they first discovered the game. And parents, as you know, they're great for handing around best practices and things. So they may be at a place like Esteban Park, and they find the game. And then when they go home to their local playground, they'll play it again and again.
Matt Toner is the CEO of Biba, a smart playground company. Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5. Good afternoon. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein.
The Israel Scouts is the largest youth organization in Israel, with more than 80,000 members. And every year, a small group of scouts takes a trip to the U.S. to perform songs, dance, and talk to people about their home country. They call it the Friendship Caravan. One group is currently in Arizona, which has hosted Israel Scout caravans since the 70s. The show's Anika Klein went to a performance.
Israel Scouts don't let their audience just sit back and watch them dance.
Raise your hands high and wave them in the sky.
Shahar Kempler is teaching the audience at the Arizona Jewish Historical Society what they need to do to dance along to the next song, Hava Nagila. Here's Kempler.
Hava Nagila is the number one Jewish song for generations.
Only this version has a modern twist. Each of the 10 scouts comes on stage and talks a little about themselves. They talk about family members and the things they love about home. Kempler again.
It opens the doors to talk about Israel and to show and to portray how Israel is today.
And not the Israel that comes up in the news. Like that last week, 4 people were killed in a terror attack in Tel Aviv. This is the reality these kids deal with back home. But their performances are an effort to look past the headlines and show how they see their country.
Tel Aviv is basically the entertainment hub for Israel. Like, anyone can find everything they need over there, and that's really what's fantastic about it.
That's Alon Maiden. He introduces the audience to a song by an Israeli pop singer. It's called Golden Boy, which he says is played in clubs all over Israel.
We often just hear about the bad stuff, the war and the terrorist acts.
Jill Leshen has been watching the Israel Scouts perform since she was a little girl. She says her trips to Israel connect her to this music.
It just brings all those wonderful memories of Israel and the people and the land and the magic of Israel back here, and it just fills my heart.
A lot of the people watching here today are similar to Leshen. In fact, when asked who has been to Israel, more than half the crowd raises their hands. But the Scouts also visit groups outside the Jewish community. Caravan leader Alanoy Bleich says they talked to a troop of Boy Scouts the other day.
They asked which disease we have in Israel, or do we walk with a camel to school? We live as everyone.
And those are some of the ideas they're trying to get across, that Israel is like other Western nations. The troop acts as cultural ambassadors, tending to focus on the country's entrepreneurial spirit rather than its history of socialist ideals. Here's Alon Maiden.
Israel, being a very young nation, has managed to produce so many different startups.
Everybody's trying to do their own thing and create their own success, he says. But before these kids can pursue something like a startup, they'll have to serve in the Israel Defense Forces. Alanoy Bleich, the caravan leader, just finished 5 years of service.
When you're in the army, you think that's what you have in life, you know, only army.
But she says she's returning to the friendship caravan with a new perspective.
And when I see those kids smile and dance and perform, I think that there will be peace, you know what I mean? Like, it makes me feel very hopeful.
For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
The Israel Scouts are performing again in Phoenix and Scottsdale tonight and tomorrow.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.